Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
KDK Pittsburgh, listen to what we started.
This is KDKA
of the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company.
The future really did begin here. The world's first scheduled broadcast was made from Westinghouse's
KDKA.
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 Listen as we share 100 years of KDKA radio.
Climb aboard our magic carpet for a montage of memories. Radio's finest hour.
Someplace special.
Welcome to KDKA Radio as we celebrate 100 years. Officially, it's November the 2nd, 2020. But right now, and every single Wednesday all the way throughout the year, we are celebrating some of the highlights of KDKA Radio's past. And tonight, a very special gentleman that we'll be focusing on, Mr. George Barber. It was 43 years into KDK Radio's history that the first African-American was hired as a reporter. Mr. Barber, at 38, was able to join the team in 1964 and worked at KDK Radio all the way through until 1972. Reported on some of the most amazing news developments, not only here, but across the country, especially when he went to Selma, Alabama for the March with Dr. King. We'll get to that coming up a little bit later on. But right now we want to bring to the show Reverend Lauren Mann, who worked with George Barber when he was at KDKA. Mr. Mann, so when you came to here, Mr. Barber already here, making a name for himself as a reporter, what can you tell us about him and the ethic that he had and he brought to his work?
Well, you know, it was a real delight for me to meet George. I had followed him some years in the Pittsburgh Courier, even as a child, when living in the state of Florida. You know, the Pittsburgh Courier was the nation's major African-American newspaper, and they had regional publications. So prior to moving to Pittsburgh, I was familiar with the Pittsburgh Courier and the name George Barber. Never in my wildest dream did I think I would be one day working with George at KDKA, the oldest radio station in the world. So I was duly excited to be working at KDKA and then to have George Barber as a mentor.
What is it that set George Barber apart from others?
George was a disciple of objectivity. He was a straight shooter. He told the story as it was. He was the old kind, the old-fashioned news reporter who stood between the event and the public and gave the public an accurate report of what was happening. That was what distinguished him, and he did it with such passion. Not only was he professional, but he was passionate. He never lost the human touch.
One of the things that was important to him that I've come to understand is reporting on the African-American experience throughout Pittsburgh and southwestern Pennsylvania. Talk about that, if you could, for a moment.
Yeah, George always wanted to get what we called the other side of the story. You know the history of racism in this country. The majority of the media are white-owned facilities and entities. And George always wanted to show the experience of the African-American and paint it in a good light, because so often in media, historically, we've not had that. And George always had a penchant for doing that and doing it so well.
We are joined now by the Reverend Loren Mann. He's talking about George Barber that we're honoring this hour. Coming up a little bit later on, maybe the highlight of his career, if it's fair to say that, is the reporting that he did at Selma. Talk about the significance of being a part of that event and what that meant to him.
It meant so much to George. He and I talked about that several times, and some of his experiences along the way. First of all, George was so committed to the profession, but more than that, George was happy to be a part of American history and to see it unfolding right before his eyes, and then to have the ability and the opportunity to report firsthand what was happening on that march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama, in such a crucial time of our country. I don't think George was about so much about being a part of history as he was witnessing history. He was there. He saw it. He saw the passion of the demonstrators and Dr. King and those who marched with him. And at the same time, he witnessed the horror of the hatred of the South and the tremendous opposition that they were getting in their onward march. It was more than a march from Selma to Montgomery. It was really a march to freedom, a greater, and as the fathers of the U.S. Constitution or the Declaration of Independence said, a more perfect union. And for him to witness that, it had an incalculable positive effect on his life, and he was never the same.
You mentioned earlier that he was committed to objectivity. How do you see Mr. Barber, if he was able to, covering the news of today, especially in light of the death of Mr. Floyd and the protests that have come across the country as a result of that?
George would tell it as it is. There's an old slogan that good meat makes its own gravy. He would not be one to assume an advocacy position unless he were asked for that. But you could depend upon George for accurate reporting. He would tell the story as it is, even if it did not reflect well upon African Americans.
That's a pretty bold statement to make, in a very bold position to take. I mean, it's oftentimes one where we have that bias within us to want to protect our own.
George was always committed to telling the truth, even when the truth was ugly.
Reverend Loren Mann joining us on the Disc Institute of Pittsburgh Newsline. Sir, I do appreciate your willingness to take a couple of minutes out and help us to remember Mr. George Barber. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Robert. It's been my pleasure to be with you.
Once again, Loren Mann, KDKA's first African-American staff announcer, remembering the career of George Barber, KDKA Radio's first African-American reporter who worked here from 1964 to 1972. You get to hear George Barber coming up next on KDKA Radio.
Celebrating 100 years.
Listen to what we start.
KDKA Radio with Robert Mangino.
I'm Mangino. Thank you very much for tuning in to this very special KDKA Radio at 100. We are remembering Mr. George Barber, KDKA Radio's first African-American reporter. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, famous and honored as he was still not really known to many in the 60s. KDKA Radio newsman George Barber recalled his own impressions as he reported on two of the most famous incidents in a famous life. George prepared a report that aired on KDKA Radio in 1968. A reporter remembers Martin Luther King. Here's a portion of that presentation with George Barber.
Most men, especially great men, are associated with their deeds. Martin Luther King, almost alone among the men, is associated with cities, for there is a succession of city names, lay the story of his deeds. St. Augustine, Birmingham, Montgomery, Jackson, Selma. I remember him from Selma and Montgomery in 1966, and one other city. Selma was to be the first great test of his nonviolent strategy to gain civil rights. The test began on a bloody Sunday in March. They were mousetrapped by a police force, tear-gassed, poked with electric cattle prods, and injured from the hooves of horses. The world gasped, and so did Dr. King, but King did a little more. He promised to march with the people to Montgomery, and he vowed that their letter of protest would be delivered personally to Governor George Wallace, and Dr. King asked others to join the march. They did so by the hundreds. They came to Selma in such numbers that soon there were more than 4,000 of them. Nobody cared much about the exact date in March. It was after Bloody Sunday. They all seemed attuned to some invisible force. The personification of the force was an ordinary-looking man, short of stature, square-shouldered, and with a bushy mustache and a rather expressionless face. He was ordinary, it seemed, except when he spoke. And when he spoke, it was in terms of racial injustices and the use of nonviolence to erase these injustices. And when he spoke, he was a focus of attention of all within the listening range. And so it was for Selma. The march was set for the morning. It didn't come off as scheduled, and he was nowhere to be seen, but nobody left. They knew he would appear. Dr. King had a problem. A federal court had banned the march. He discussed it with his top aides at an undisclosed location. The thousands waited. I talked with a good cross-section in the meantime. They agreed on their fear and on their determination to follow Dr. King wherever he would lead them.
Sir, I'm rather scared. I was rather bothered by the legality of the situation, but I'm rather overcome by the moral issues at stake, which caused me to come down here in the first place.
They knew that Dr. King would appear, and it wasn't long before a rousing cheer went up. Suddenly, there was King himself on the steps of the church. He would march, and they would obey, and he was at the head of a moving line, and it was high noon in Selma. The demonstrators moved through tense and brittle downtown Selma. Dr. King was at his usual serene self as he was linked by arms with his fellow marchers. The obstacle, the bridge, loomed ahead, and beyond it, cold steel. They had weapons and were ready to die in a pitched battle with police. But Dr. King did not want a vengeance. He wanted justice and a demonstration. And he got what he wanted, almost.
We had here today the greatest demonstration for freedom, the greatest confrontation that we've had in the South. I would say around 4,000 of us were able to do something in Selma today that we've never been able to do before. We decided that at least we had to move to the point where the brutality took place Sunday. We decided that we had to stand up and confront the state troopers who committed this police brutality.
Yes, sir.
Now, we also decided along with that in accord with our nonviolent spirit, the nonviolent movement, that we would not seek to break through a line of state troopers that assembled there. But we made it clear that we had to march. And today I'm proud to say that we did march, we did reach that point, and we stayed on the highway of the state of Alabama, and we had a prayer service and a freedom rally. I want to remind you that we still plan to march on the Capitol in Montgomery. But I hope that everybody under the sound of my voice will remember this and stand on call, and that we will go to Montgomery next week in numbers that no man can number.
No.
Dr. King did return with an estimated 25,000, and his sincerity also got the government to protect the marchers with 1,800 federalized Alabama National Guardsmen, some 1,000 regular Army troops, helicopters and light planes, and some 100 FBI agents and federal marshals. The who's who of the 25,000 people could be looked on as an example of the drawing power of the mystique of Dr. King. There were the great and the near great, the humble and the not so humble, the blind and the crippled. There were elderly people and the young and children, and they belonged to every conceivable race, creed, and color. And they walked the 50 miles. And among the others to join were Pete Seeger, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Odetta, Harry Belafonte, TV producer Robert Gist, and there was Rabbi Abram Heschel of New York City, who saw so much goodness in Dr. King that he followed him in the march.
One of the tremendous encouragement to see how many people are personally involved in it, and our optimism about the future is increasing.
The civil rights leader preached unity among the races, and his demonstration in Selma was a testimony to his belief. King's spiritual qualities were great, and with him at the head of the march, the spirit of 65 was really a modern-day version of the spirit of 76. His determination kept the marchers together. They wore out shoes, and then they walked barefooted. Dr. King was going to make it, and so were they. They were going to make it together. And they did, and were happy. And Governor Wallace got the message. And it was tough in St. Augustine and Birmingham and Montgomery and Selma and again Montgomery. In fact, it was so rough for Dr. Martin Luther King that his name is automatically associated with those cities today. Perhaps the only man with such a distinction. All those cities are much better because he was arrested or jailed or humiliated in them and still clung to his love of mankind. I mentioned several cities. There's one more, Pittsburgh. He was here a year or so ago. He was at the University of Pittsburgh to talk with students. Following that informal chat, he walked over and shook hands with me and asked how I was doing. I didn't think he would remember me. There were hundreds of reporters covering that Selma march. But this genteel man, who became more than his ordinary appearance when talking of nonviolence, did remember. He was a giant to many and a force to be reckoned with to all. He was a man who blended mind, body, and spirit to a single purpose. He's gone now, but Martin Luther King had a familiar personal theme, that the love of mankind will enable man to survive. This is George Barber.
Mr. George Barber, what a man, what a reporter. And what a storyteller. And speaking of stories, it was years ago he was on with Lynn Hayes Freeland on her weekly show, honoring the 25th anniversary of the March on Selma. The remarkable experience that he had while he was there reporting, you've got to hear this for yourself. And it's next on KDKA Radio as we celebrate KDKA's 100 years.
Celebrating 100 years.
Listen to what we start!
KDKA Radio with Robert Mangino.
Welcome back. I'm Mangino. KDKA at 100 is what we're celebrating. The individual tonight is George Barber, the first African-American reporter on KDKA. And maybe the biggest story he covered was the march from Selma to Montgomery. In 1990, 25 years since the march from Selma, and he was on the Lynn Hayes Freeland show at the time and had a most remarkable story to tell about how he was able to convince local management here at KDKA to fly him to Selma to cover the march. Here is Mr. George Barber.
To me, Selma was indeed a point that indicated that our country was indeed going to move towards a road to democracy because of the voting rights. It was just, I just thank the good Lord I was able to cover that, to have the opportunity to cover. I mention that because being a civil rights advocate at heart and being a professional broadcast journalist, news person, I felt as though that I could not go out and actively campaign, but I could, by reporting accurately what was happening, I could do my bit and sacrificing myself on the line in case, and it was a sacrifice indeed. I like to point out here, Lynn, that in order to get the opportunity to go, I always pride myself on being having black Yankee ingenuity, being able to accomplish things that seemingly were impossible to accomplish. When it came up concerning the march, KDK was not going to send anybody to cover. And so I approached Jack Williams, who was then the general manager, the program director of KDK Radio. And so I...
And this is you at the march.
That is me
right
at the march.
Okay.
Yes, that's me at the march. And that's on the first day of the march.
Okay.
The Sunday that we shoved out from Selma. And over to the left, you see a village. And this was a village that I dashed over to make a report back to KDK Radio. I tried all along the way to get a report in, but said, no, you're not going to make a report here. I was able to find a black village at that time, a little hamlet, and I ran up as far as I could into the line of marchers who were escorted by federal troops and nationalized guards. And I dashed across to the village, and I asked if I could use a telephone there, and certainly it was welcome. And I called, I said to Bill Steinbach, who was on radio at that time, and this was a Sunday afternoon, I said to Bill, I can only give you a 30-second or a minute report on, because I have to get back in the line, and I'll probably be killed if I don't get there where the guards are and where the troops are. And Bill said, look, you remember how you got to go? You told us, in order to convince Jack Williams, you said that every job had its occupational hazard. And you pointed out about a policeman, a fireman, a coal miner, and a news reporter, and you, a black news reporter, that's an occupational hazard, too, and that's the reason why he sent you. And he said, since it's an occupational hazard, this is the greatest story in the world right now, and you're going to have to give me more. You're going to give me more than 30 seconds or a minute and 10. So Bill and I talked, and we talked. And the more we talked, that reporter came out. That reporter aspect of me came out, and I was talking about what was happening, all the people, the different people, what have you. And finally, I realized we had been talking for about 50 minutes. And I said, Bill, I'm going. I have to get out there. And so I dashed out. I went with my pack. I had a bed pack and the whole old Ewer tape recorders, dashed out to the village, down the moat, up the other side of the moat, out on the road, and at that time all the people were dispersing, and I could see the marchers nowhere in sight, and I was determined that I was going to get back to my job, to the assignment. I turned down the road and started running, and perhaps it was because of the shock of seeing this black man loaded down with all kind of equipment, with two tape recorders and what have you, that shocked in such a way that I was able to get a little advantage on them in running down the road. And finally I heard somebody said, there's one of them. He's alone. Let's get him. And so the race began, with me out front and quite a number behind. And I let them know, as I was running down the road, I was turning around and letting them know that I am not one of the nonviolent kind. If somebody gets me, whoever it is, somebody's going to go down with me. And lo and behold, I guess I was traveling pretty fast. I used to be a good football player. I was going pretty good, I guess. And lo and behold, almost like Hollywood, I saw around the curve in the road the backs of the troops, the bayonets, and so forth. And it was a happy sight, and I hit that line like Jim Brown and went right through it. So I was able to get the reports in, and it was That was the first of a number of incidents in which...
Okay, I'm going to have you talk through those, but you mentioned so many things I want to pick up on. Let's go back to you as a black reporter in 1965. How rare was that in terms of the coverage of the Selma March?
That was very rare, indeed. With exception of Ebony Magazine, and with, I think it was Haynes from the Washington Post, those were about the only black reporters there, yes.
How did your being black affect the stories that you sent back?
The stories I sent back were reports. I could take a fish-eyed look at the reports, at what was happening. For instance, I recall one marcher, and she obviously was up in age, and I had to talk with her. And I asked her the simple question, says, why are you marching? And she, at that time, she was in her bare feet. I know she was struggling. And she said, you know, I'm 72 years of age, and I'm not going to be here much longer. I'm marching for a better day for my children and my children's children. God bless her. I'll never forget her.
Mr. George Barber. Coming up next, a man who says he now stands on the shoulders of George Barber. KDKA Radio's own Chris Moore joins us as we celebrate KDKA at 100 on KDKA Radio.
Celebrating 100 years.
Listen to what we started.
KDKA Radio with Robert Mangino.
We're celebrating KDK Radio at 100. I'm Mangino. Thank you very much for tuning in. We're honoring George Barber, the first African-American reporter at KDK Radio, who was hired at the age of 38 back in 1964. There's one man in particular who says that he now stands on that man's shoulders, and he's our own Chris Moore. I had the opportunity to sit and talk with Chris about Mr. Barber, and we started off with when he first learned of George Barber. Here's Chris Moore.
Now, I probably met Mr. Barber somewhere around 1985 here in Pittsburgh. I moved here in 80, and I discovered his rich history. I interviewed him a number of times on Black Horizons, and we got one of his audio recordings when he was covering for KDK Radio the march to Selma that Dr. King did. Mm-hmm. And it was just a true joy to hear that and listen to it and see what his early work was like. Also, he often spoke to our students at our workshop. I always tried to include him so that they knew the shoulders that I stood on and knew people like Mr. Barber who had gone before a lot of us in my generation and Lynn Hayes Freeland's generation, so that they would have some respect for the early work that they did and the kind of danger that they put themselves into.
He came to KDKA in 1964, newspaper career in the 50s before that. Talk about the struggles, the way that you understand them and the way that he related them to you, being an African-American and choosing the field of journalism to get into.
Well, he and Dr. Edna McKenzie, who also worked for the Courier, used to tell me stories about how they would challenge segregation here. And they would go out into the Mon Valley and just go in a restaurant with Teenie Harris, the photographer, and sit down and order a cup of coffee. And they would be told, well, you know, if you were from around here, you wouldn't be in here. And they were told by their editor that they had to go out and challenge segregation and put themselves on the line as journalists. And that's what they did. You know, who knows what could happen to them, even up south here, in challenging segregated places of eating and I guess hotels and anything else. And they would go out there and challenge it. And when they were not served, they would write a story about it. Mr. Harris would take a picture, and the Courier would publish it, and they would, and that's how they publicly challenged segregation.
You know, it's one thing as a journalist, you're observing what's happening to other people, and then writing about those observations. It's almost like an investigative reporter, but there can be such passions associated with the issue of race and racism and bigotry. These men were really willing to put their own health and lives on the line in order to get a story, in order to tell a story. What compelled him, in your understanding, to want to go that far in covering stories that way and topics that way?
Well, they told me their editor was P. happens to be the father of Patricia Pratis Jennings, who was the principal pianist for the Pittsburgh Symphony for a number of years. She's retired now. But they said Mr. Pratis was a man of principle. He was a man who told them that not only did they not have to do what journalists did to dispassionately write about the story, but in order to challenge the evils of their time, they had to put themselves in the story. And that meant going out and actually doing those kind of almost lunch counter sit-ins or looking for service somewhere, and then writing about why they were denied. So I think it takes a special kind of courage to put yourself on the line. But they both told me that Mr. Pratis was the driving motivation for doing journalism that challenged the racism of the day.
We're talking with Chris Moore, and we're talking about George Barber, amazing reporter that worked for KDK from the mid-60s into the early to mid-70s. Before that, great career over at the Pittsburgh Courier as well. And you mentioned earlier, Chris, that you stand on his shoulders. In what sense?
Absolutely.
In what sense do you mean that?
Well, he was the pioneer. Again, I don't have to do what Mr. Barber did. I don't have to put myself in the story. I don't have to go out and publicly challenge segregation. I can watch these demonstrations. I can interview people on both sides. My life is never threatened, like when he covered the march to Selma. So absolutely I stand on his shoulders, because now he has made the field of journalism or talk show host, which is what I call myself, a much easier thing to do. I seldom get threatened for the things that I write about or say on the air, but he was threatened all the time for that. And so you have to admire his principles, his courage, and his ability to be a journalist all at the same time. So I stand on his shoulders, yes, by all means, because I don't have to go through what he went through. He made it better for me and easier.
From what I've been reading regarding Mr. Barber, the journalistic integrity, his skill in being able to write stories, to discover stories, to then speak those stories as he worked in radio, is one that rises up with the greats that we've ever had at KDK Radio and News.
I would agree with that. If you listen to, I have one of his tapes, a part of it, covering the march to Selma. He talks about boarding a plane here in Pittsburgh at 1:30 in the morning. He interviews people on the plane, people from Massachusetts and other states who had come to board that plane and answer Dr. King's call for people of goodwill to come together and march. And they talk about their reasons for that. And it's a remarkable document in history where many people of all persuasions, he talked to ministers, he talked to women, he talked to a number of people who really felt the urge to challenge segregation in the United States like it was never challenged before. And if you listen to it, you see the flow from that flight to actually getting there, to going to meetings, to interviewing people on the ground, not just the ministers and the high-class people who were there based on commitment, but the people who suffered under that system. You can hear their Southern accents. And he asked them, why are they there? Why do they want to march? And they would answer very simply, for my freedom. And so they talk about the things that they had to undergo, mm-hmm. and when it was time for that to change. And then you actually hear Dr. King urging people to be involved and get involved. And so I think it's a remarkable document that he leads us from Pittsburgh to the gathering of people from all over the nation and why they're there, to the people who were there suffering under the discriminatory system of the South. And then you hear Dr. King speak. And so I think it's a remarkable document. And again, he didn't know what was going to happen. No one knew on that march that they were going to be attacked. There were all sorts. James Meredith was shot on another march similar to that. So you didn't know what was going to happen. But he met the challenge, and he met it head on.
Chris Moore is with us. We're talking about George Barber, a reporter for KDK Radio from 64 to 72. How do you think Mr. Barber would be covering the protests as they're occurring today, obviously around the country, but most notably here in Pittsburgh?
He'd probably say it was a piece of cake compared to what he used to do, because I don't think he'd feel that his life was threatened, even though there's been violence in these demonstrations and a number of other things that have gone on. I think he would have a certain amount of joy. I remember when he used to come speak to our workshop students, and even his memories then, he recalled with a lot of humor and laughter about times when he didn't know what sort of dodgy situation he had gotten himself into in trying to cover this for KDKA. And so he was just full of life and energy, and you couldn't stop him from talking about stuff. As a matter of fact, we had to try to stop him, but he held the students' interest in all that he went through. And I think that many of us, even those who don't know him, owe him a great debt of gratitude for what he did before us.
We're talking about George Barber and his career here at KDK Radio, and with us, Chris Moore, joining us on the Disc Institute of Pittsburgh Newsline. Chris, thank you for your insights and your passion regarding Mr. Barber and bringing this to our attention.
He is one of my heroes, and I respect him a great deal. I'm glad to talk about him anytime.
You can listen to this episode and share it with your friends and learn a whole lot more about George Barber by going to our website, kdkradio.com. That's KDK Radio at 100. I'm Angino, KDK Radio.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it, with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in baseball isn't boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.